Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of the state of Obama's foreign policy pivot towards Asia on the eve of his eight-day trip starting on Tuesday to Japan, South Korea, Malaysia, and the Philippines. Steve Clemens, the Washington editor-at-large for The Atlantic and editor-in-chief of Atlantic Live, who co-founded with Chalmers Johnson the Japan Policy Research Institute, joins us to discuss what appears to the Chinese to be a policy of containing them and the failed reset of relations with Russia now that Obama seems to have written off Putin as we head in the direction of a new Cold War with a containment policy to isolate and make Russia a pariah state. Then we will speak with a leading international expert on contemporary Ukraine, Taras Kuzio, who is a fellow with the Center for Transatlantic Relations at the School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University. We will look into the shaky truce between armed separatists in eastern Ukraine and a weak, inept government in Kiev trying to exert authority over restive provinces thoroughly infiltrated by Russian intelligence and paramilitary forces who appear to have staged a shooting at a checkpoint given the speed with which the Russian TV network controlled by Putin's close friend Dmitry Kislyov showed up at the scene and stoked outrage across the Russian media. Then finally, we'll discuss the Detroit bankruptcy and the change of fortune for the city's pensioners who previously were going to get pennies on the dollar while the banks who entangled Detroit in risky financial deals that blew up in the 2008 Wall Street crash were about to be made largely whole. A former investment banker at Goldman Sachs, Wallace Turberville, now a senior fellow at Demos and author of their report, The Detroit Bankruptcy, joins us to discuss this turnaround and what is behind it. And joining us now is Steve Clemens, who is a Washington editor-at-large for The Atlantic and editor-in-chief of Atlantic Live. He's also a senior fellow and founder of the American Security Program at the New America Foundation, and previously Steve Clemens co-founded with Chalmers Johnson the Japan Policy Research Institute. Welcome to Background Briefing, Steve Clemens.
Great to be with you, Ian.
And I guess it does seem like a pretty harsh critique of the president to suggest that his two main foreign policy initiatives of late, the pivot towards Asia and the reset of Russia, both seem to be largely in trouble. Let's begin with the pivot to Asia. You've had the administration being, instead of getting out of the Middle East and Russia and Eastern Europe, they are getting dragged further in. Congressional Democrats have blocked Obama's bid for the 12-nation Pacific Free Trade Pact. Obama's had to cancel participation in two Asian summits because of government shutdowns last fall. So what do you think he could achieve on this trip to Japan, South Korea, Malaysia, and the Philippines, given that China, in its recent trip of Vice President Biden and his Chinese counterpart, accused and threatened, saying that, with Chuck Hagel, the Chinese defense minister said, you're never going to be able to contain us. And that appears to be what the Chinese think Obama's pivot's all about.
Well, an explicit containment of China would be very complicated because China is the kind of growing state that's just embedded everywhere now today. And I think it's going to be hard to do that. But nonetheless, I think that, you know, maintaining a relatively strong presence in Asia has been a strategic priority of the Obama administration. And as you've said, it's been a very, very tough go because, you know, life and global problems happen and they compel the White House to react. And I think what Obama's been trying to do, and I think he's had relative success, more success than I think critics give him so far, is while he has to pay attention to Ukraine and while he has to sort of look at broader issues in the Middle East, he's not been deploying new troops there. He's not been, you know, doing what George W. Bush would have done and what John McCain and other Republican critics have wanted him to do, which is to throw everything he has into these crises that are not on the strategic map that he wants to go. And so I think, you know, Chuck Hagel, Joe Biden, Barack Obama have been trying to, you know, tell allies in Asia that America will maintain a strong presence during a time of budget drawdown and during a time when withdrawals from Afghanistan are underway, and try not to be sucked deeply into other problems. And notice I said the word deeply because they are being sucked in somewhat. And I think he has to thread that needle very carefully between not becoming an overly reactive president to everything and trying to maintain some strategic contours of what his foreign policy is about.
But it does seem, Steve Clements, that all of the stops on Obama's trip starting on Tuesday to Asia, Japan, followed by South Korea, Malaysia, and then finally the Philippines, all of those nations have one thing in common, which is that they have territorial disputes with China, largely over rocks, what is often called piles of rocks in the South China Sea.
Absolutely. I mean, the level of Chinese propaganda efforts to sort of assert that all of the South China Sea is part of its historic sovereignty have been remarkable. And as you recall, I went with Joe Biden on his plane and covered the Biden trip to Asia in December. And while it wasn't exactly the same countries we were in China, Japan, and Korea, and at that time you had President Park in Korea and Prime Minister Abe in Japan, who hadn't spent more than 30 seconds on stage with each other, who really deeply dislike one another. So part of what is driving the president's trip is assuring erstwhile allies that America is going to maintain a presence and to try to send a signal to China, because he's not stopping in China, that America is engaged and will be there. Whether that's puffery or not, we'll have to wait and see. But I think also part of it is to get these countries to deal with each other more responsibly. We have a trade deal, as you said, has been scuttled for the time being in the Congress, not a lot of support there. So the president can't go and give that gift. But, I mean, you and I and Chalmers Johnson talked many, many times about Japanese kind of mercantilism that continues without a lot of attention. And, you know, yet again, it's kind of a playback to the 1980s. Japan's auto market sector, which, you know, remains relatively impervious to U.S. exports and European exports to some degree, is the sticking point for the Japanese in TPP, which many people projected it would be. So that's you know, really hampering the president's opportunities there. And then on the security front, there, whether or not I think the president is sort of maintaining an Asia focus, much of the world doesn't think that. And that's the problem. There's a perception gap between the credibility and solvency of an Asia pivot and what people see as an inchoate kind of commitment to the region.
But given that relations between Japan and South Korea are at their lowest point, as many have argued, since World War II, and now that Japan, with its assertive right-wing government, are now planning to put a military radar station about 90 miles from the Senkaku island group claimed by China at this new base on Yonaguni Island, how is that going to, obviously the Chinese will respond fairly forcefully, will they not?
It makes everything worse. I mean, they're going to station about 150 troops there at full force in this exchange, in this new radar facility that's being talked about. And the defense minister, Onodera, has come out and said that, you know, he thought that an expansion of these military posts for the so-called defense of Japan could be expanded to other islands. So it has thrown something that used to be in a balance and kind of had an equilibrium with a lot of ambiguity. While Japan and China both play to the darkest nationalists in each of their quarters, it is driving and escalating national impulses that very well could take Japan and China into an unintended conflict where the two barely talk with each other, and could create not only a conflict between themselves, but something that draws the United States in by treaty. It's one of the most scary fault lines in the world today. And I think that Vice President Biden, when he was there in December, tried to get these leaders to think more maturely and you know, frankly, you know, less recklessly about the words they use, about their calls, you know, on historical memory, and about their accusations. And as Chalmers Johnson and I used to argue, there is a downside to American military presence in the region, that if China, Japan, and Korea believe fundamentally that the United States will, at its core, prevent conflict in the region, then that allows those leaders to be incredibly reckless with their rhetoric, with their posturing, with the kinds of things they're doing. And it's lending itself to things like we're seeing with this radar installation, which is changing the status quo regarding these islands that have, you know, disputed claims over them. I think China's doing the same thing, but nobody really knows how it's all started now. One is blaming the other. It's moving in dangerous territory.
Well, it does seem in many ways that here we are about to have the 100th anniversary of the beginning of World War One, where diplomatic failures and blunders led to the war to end all wars, which was a huge cauldron of death and destruction, completely unnecessary, completely avoidable, but largely the great powers were sucked in because of their entangled alliances and relations with surrogates. So to what extent do you think that we could get sucked into larger conflicts, both in Ukraine if there's a civil war and there's a great deal of alarm over Putin's recent remarks about Novorossiya, and there's a sense that in the Baltics of concern that all of the Russian minorities in those countries could be stirred up. So you have that potential crisis erupting in Europe. And then you've got the idea that we do have agreements with some of these countries like Japan, do we not? That if they provoke something with China, what do we do?
Ian, you've hit the target right on the head. And David Ignatius in the Washington Post yesterday, folks can Google it, wrote a piece about the battle of men in preceding the World War One who wanted to seem bold and strong and unyielding, and how this escalatory masculinity that was part of the leadership circles of the early 20th century and a lot of other structural factors seem so similar to some of what was driving in Ukraine. His focus was on Ukraine, not Asia, and particularly Putin's behavior. And he said, we may be very lucky that Barack Obama seems like, you know, the kid with his shirt, you know, tied up to the top, sitting up, you know, sort of like a nerd in the front of the room who understands that strategic restraint has to be part of the picture of these cases. But I have to say that both in Asia and with some of what we've seen in Ukraine, too many of the patterns, too much of the posturing, a lot of the media attention, a lot of the public reaction, not just, you know, here, but, you know, when you look inside Russia, you look inside the different factions inside Ukraine, you look at the debates within Japan, within Korea, and within China, between what I would call healthy nationalists and dark nationalists, it has a feel as if each of these steps that are being taken are so symbolic and so imbued with importance for domestic political ramifications in each of these respective countries that it has a 1914 feel. And we should all be very, very worried about it. And then when you see some of the criticism of the president for not getting up, not throwing everything he had at Vladimir Putin, not starting a war or throwing, you know, large-scale military weapons into Ukraine, that people look at this as a sign of appeasement and a sign of weakness. I tell people, be worried about the 1914 model. Be very worried, because we could be, as you said, over a pile of rocks or over issues that have dynamics that have nothing to do with us, particularly inside Ukraine. It's very important to give people an opportunity for leadership, but as I think John Kerry said the other day, there's some nasty sides to this Ukrainian dimension. We had some towns with Jewish residents inside Ukraine issued notices that they would have to start identifying themselves and wearing identification. This has rings of the 1930s, and we all should be worried. I think you hit it right on the head.
Well, what do you think then, and what do you make of the New York Times story on Sunday, a front page story about how the Obama administration seemed to have written off Putin, and that we may be heading into
Peter Baker's story, I think.
Yes, that's right.
Peter Baker of the New York Times has written something which I think it has a couple of components to it. One, that Obama has decided that despite the best efforts of the administration, that Putin has decided to be the naughty guy in class and to identify himself and define himself by the trouble he can make. I think that may be a mistake, but what I found interesting is that it goes on to say that though we will never have a constructive relationship with Putin, it doesn't say we can't be engaged with Russia. It does say we're going to engage, try to institutionalize a containment strategy a la George Kennan, which will be a mix of containment and a mix of engagement. Now, what I find potentially useful about this is that while I don't think Ukraine per se can be saved. I think it's been a mistake for some time to think, whether it was over LGBT issues or, you have to go back to what Putin is doing inside his country. When you look at what happened with Pussy Riot, what you saw happening with various critics of the Putin administration inside Russia, a lot of what he's doing externally, I believe, has to do with mollifying a domestic population and keeping himself from becoming politically vulnerable inside Russia. That said, Russia seems to have lots of pressure points with us, and the United States and the West seem to have very few pressure points with Russia. And I think that it's been a mistake to silo each problem or challenge we have with Russia, whether it's Syria or dealing with issues in the North China Sea or the North Pacific, dealing with Iran matters, or dealing, you know, now with Ukraine and kind of Moldova and some of this kind of ethnic nationalism with Russia to the rescue, if you will. I think we don't have a lot of leverage points. We've been dealing with each of the square on the chessboard unto itself without looking more broadly. I don't want to see Russia, I don't want to see Russia in essentially demonized to such a point where we can't engage it. I see that happening in the United States. But I think the Peter Baker piece says that essentially the administration realizes finally that it needs to realize it has a global game going on with Russia, and it needs to find where those leverage points are. My hope is that they couple that with the notion that no matter who the leader of is Russia, they've got to try to work on developing a constructive relationship with Russia, because it is one of the great global stakeholders. Lots of nuclear weapons, member of the Permanent Five, important global economy, important oil and energy and gas producer in the world. All of those issues make Russia a nation you can't avoid dealing with. So they've got to find something that's better. And I worry a little bit about these stories that come out saying, oh, now we're going to have an era where we're only tough on Russia. That's not realistic. It's very naive.
But is there a way that you can be tough on Putin and not tough on Russia? I mean, Putin is clearly has changed the subject and is distracting the Russian people from his own kleptocracy, albeit the Ukrainian situation exploded over his kleptocrat that he had in Ukraine, who just got too greedy. But
yeah, I mean,
obviously,
Putin has a big series of kleptocrats around him. And I think that, however, I mean, one of my small differences with the administration on what it has done, and, you know, people disagree, is that despite sanctioning, and that means constraining the resources and the options and the travel of the cronies around Putin, that may play well domestically, but it's not taken seriously. I mean, part of what's going on in Russia is that Russians, he's very popular with basic Russians. He looks to them, if you will, like their Ronald Reagan, who's taking a problematic country and reasserting Russia as a great state in the world. And it's morning in Moscow. And so when a great state like that sees the United States sanction individuals, it's not perceived as serious. If we had sanctioned sectors in ways that, you know, possibly cause some harm, we're trying to deter Russia on the cheap. And I think that was a big mistake. I think we should not have gone after individuals and sanctions as we did, or if we did, at least couple them to sectoral reforms. But we thought by basically just dealing with Putin, the mobster, with the mob connections, if you will, with various oligarchs that are his pals and buddies, that that would change the direction of the nation. And I think that really was a mistake and underestimated the resolve that Putin has in his legacy building to go down in history in Russia as the guy who restored some semblance of what the Soviets were.
But just in closing, Steve Clements, how much is Putin really about making Russia greater and stronger and more solvent and more democratic? Let's forget that one. But or how much is he, as he appears to be, somewhat obsessed with trying to not so much build Russia up, but tear America down? I mean, the story that Hank Paulson told about the Chinese at the time of the 2008 crash coming to him, saying that Putin was trying to get them, the Chinese, to dump all of their Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac holdings, which would have completely tanked the economy. If there's any truth to that, this guy...
I think they're tied together. I think he would like to see the United States humiliated and weakened. And so that's one of the reasons why they've been playing tough in Syria. They're trying to find points that I think humiliate, that bring down the United States a notch, because he believes the United States humiliated the Soviet Union, showed significant amounts of disrespect, and his job now is to reassert Russian confidence and status in the world. And so these are combined, and with the oil and energy and gas resources he has, which are enormous, and the ability to put pressure on key strategic relationships that the United States has with countries like Japan and with Europe, notwithstanding the eastern parts of Europe that are such big consumers of Russian product and Russian gas supplies, that he thinks that he can gain leverage in those relationships and weaken the ties between some of these allies in the United States. It is a very, very tough time because, as you know, Europe is on the edge of a deflationary black hole, and the United States is not growing robustly. And if you don't have money and resources that can support your foreign policy and national security strategy globally, other nations will take advantage of it. And that's what he's doing. So he's using this moment to basically push chips around the world that are tied to both, which is a resurgent Russia and at the same time tied to some degree to humiliating the United States where he can. And to a certain degree, he's succeeding here and there, not completely, but that's what his agenda is.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Steve Clemens.
My pleasure, Ian. Thank you.
Thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Steve Clemens, who is the Washington Editor-at-Large for The Atlantic and Editor-in-Chief of Atlantic Live. He's also a senior fellow and founder of the American Security Program at the New America Foundation. And previously, Steve Clemens co-founded with Chalmers Johnson the Japan Policy Research Institute. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with a leading international expert on contemporary Ukraine.